From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerome Kern is considered the dean of American theater music. On today's Fresh Air, we hear why as we continue our series on American popular song. We'll listen to the early theater music of Jerome Kern, songs from his shows that preceded his 1927 musical Showboat, songs he wrote before such hits as Smoke It's in Your Eyes, All the Things You Are, and The Way You Look Tonight. We'll be joined by conductor and Kern expert John McGlynn and guest singers Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky. The music of Jerome Kern coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Officials with the National Transportation Safety Board say the search for the wreckage of Egyptair Flight 990 has moved from the search and rescue phase into the search and recovery phase. They say there's now no hope of finding any survivors, and they're turning their attention to recovering remains and debris, beginning a long investigation into what caused the jet to drop out of the sky early Sunday morning. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports from Newport, Rhode Island.
From the start, there was slim hope that anyone survived the crash of Egyptair Flight 990. Now the Coast Guard says there is no hope. Had anyone survived the impact, nobody could have withstood more than 36 hours in the chilly ocean waters. Now efforts turn to recovery. The Coast Guard has detected a ping, a possible signal from one of the jet's black boxes, which could provide important clues as to what went wrong. Investigators, who include FBI agents, won't speculate, but National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Jim Hall says all leads will be pursued.
I have learned on each and every accident investigation never to rule in or rule out anything. The facts will lead us where the facts will lead us.
Meanwhile, family members of the victims have begun arriving in Rhode Island for the difficult task of saying a final goodbye to their loved ones. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Newport.
Football star Walter Payton died today at his home in Chicago. He was 45. Payton suffered from a rare liver disease and had been waiting for the past 9 months for a liver transplant. As a running back for the Chicago Bears, Payton set an all-time rushing record for the National Football League, and he helped the Bears to their only Super Bowl championship. Former Bears coach Mike Ditka said today that Payton was the best football player he'd ever seen at any position. After being told this morning that they could not use a gay panic strategy to defend their client, defense lawyers in the murder trial of Aaron McKinney rested their case this afternoon. Wyoming Public Radio's Heather Feeney reports from Laramie.
McKinney's attorneys called one final witness this afternoon, a man who testified he punched Matthew Shepard twice after Shepard made what the man felt was a homosexual advance toward him in August of 1998. The man, who now lives outside Detroit, testified by phone that he had a momentary lapse of reason when he hit Shepard. The prosecution did not object to the testimony, even though it appeared to suggest the gay panic defense the judge disallowed this morning. The defense then emerged from a conference in the judge's chambers to say they were resting their case. The judge told jurors they will receive final instructions tomorrow after closing statements are presented. For NPR News, I'm Heather Feeney in Laramie.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 81 points to close at 10,648. Advances led declines in heavy trading of 835 million shares. This is NPR. Republican leaders in Congress and the president may be closer to working out their differences over the budget. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott said today that the two sides could reach an agreement without making another trip to the White House for talks with President Clinton. White House Chief of Staff John Podesta outlined some of the things the president wants in the budget, including more teachers, reduced class sizes in the nation's public schools, hiring more police, and spending more on environmental concerns. A federal judge has sentenced former Democratic fundraiser Charlie Tree to 4 months of home detention and 3 years of probation. Tree had pleaded guilty to two campaign finance violations arising from the 1996 Clinton re-election campaign. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Tree left the country as the fundraising scandal broke, but he returned, and now he's cooperating with the Justice Department. His sentence includes 200 hours of community service and a $5,000 fine, and it's actually tougher than the prosecutors had recommended. Tree was a Little Rock restaurateur when he got to know Governor Bill Clinton. Later, Tree got into the import-export business, and the president appointed him to an advisory panel on Pacific trade. Tree liked to bring overseas visitors to the White House, including some with ties to the Chinese military. But investigators never found evidence that linked those visits, money transfers to Tree from overseas, big contributions to the Democratic Party, and Clinton administration policy decisions. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index rose a little more than 1 point to close at 29,067. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with another edition in our series on American popular song. That's composer Jerome Kern at a 1940 concert performing one of his most popular songs, Smoke It's in Your Eyes. It's one in a long list of his songs that became standards, a list that includes All the Things You Are, Old Man River, Yesterday's, and The Way You Look Tonight. Kern wrote for movie musicals from 1935 to his death in 1945 at the age of 60. Before Hollywood, he wrote for the stage. He's generally acknowledged as the first great composer of American theater music, the composer who broke away from European operetta to develop an American voice. His 1927 Broadway musical Showboat ushered in the modern era of musicals. Our program today focuses on his theater songs that preceded Showboat, songs he wrote between 1905 and 1920 that show the development of his genius. We'll talk with conductor John McGlynn, a leading authority on Kern's music. Kern's early songs will be sung by our guest performers. Rebecca Luker starred in the Broadway revivals of Showboat and The Sound of Music. George Dvorsky sang the leading roles in the New York City opera productions of Cinderella and Brigadoon. Our guest pianist, William Hicks, is assistant conductor and assistant chorus master at the Metropolitan Opera. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Most of the early Kern songs have been forgotten by just about everyone, present company excluded. But a couple of those songs have stayed with us and are still really familiar, and I'd like you to perform what is perhaps the most familiar of Jerome Kern's early songs, Look for the Silver Lining. And I'm going to ask you to do it for us. The lyric is by Buddy DeSilva.
Great. Please don't be offended if I preach to you a while. Tears are out of place in eyes that were meant to smile. There's a way to make your very biggest trouble small. Here's the happy secret of it all. Look for the silver lining whenever a cloud appears in the blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so the right thing to do is make it shine for you. A heart full of joy and gladness will always banish sadness and strife. So always look for the silver lining and try to find the sunny side of life.
As I wash my dishes, I'll be following your plan till I see the brightness in every pot and pan. I am sure your point of view will ease the daily grind, so I'll keep repeating in my blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so the right thing to do is make it shine for you. A heart full of joy and gladness will always banish sadness and strife. So always look for the silver lining and try to find the sunny side of life.
Thank you. That was beautiful. That was George Dvorsky and Rebecca Luker singing with William Hicks at the piano. Look for the Silver Lining has been described as almost sounding like a folk song. John McGlynn, do you know much about the circumstances under which the song was written?
Not that specific song, but when people say that so many of Kern's melodies sound like folk songs, I know what they mean. There's something about Kern that you can't really define, but he uses longish notes often with wide jumping intervals. I mean, you can't quantify it. That's why it's genius. But there's so many of his melodies that the first time you hear them, you feel like you're hearing something that you've actually known all your life and just nobody ever sang it out loud. He writes these wide open melodies.
Why don't we hear another early song by Jerome Kern, one that was popular, very popular in its time, 1914, but is virtually never done today. It's called You're Here and I'm Here. You want to sing it for us?
Let's sing.
Sure, it'll be fun.
We two are traveling in Loveland today. We've gone astray and lost our way. What matter time or place or weather if we have lost our way together? You're here and I'm here, so what do we care? The time and place do not count, it's the one who is there. Now all I ask is room for two, and to be there with only you. It would be heaven when two hearts are true, hearts like yours and mine. The skies are fair everywhere, and the sun seems to shine. And now the wide world seems a little cozy corner for you and me.
There are just two on earth and no one beside. My little bride here by my side. Not of the busy world reminds us. I only hope that no one finds us. You're here and I'm here, so what do we care? The time and place do not count, it's the one who is there. Now all I ask is room for two, and to be there with only you. It would be heaven when two hearts are true, hearts like yours and mine. The skies are fair everywhere, and the sun seems to shine. And now the wide world seems a little cozy corner for you and me. You're here and I'm here, so what do we care? The time and place do not count, it's the one who is there. Now all I ask is room for two, and to be there with only you. It would be heaven when two hearts are true, hearts like yours and mine. The skies are fair everywhere, and the sun seems to shine. And now the wide world seems a little cozy corner for you and me.
Thank you. That was singers Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky with William Hicks at the piano. Now, I understand George Gershwin is said to have loved that song. It was very successful in terms of sheet music sales. What really interests me is that a few days after the song was first performed on stage, it was recorded by James Reese Europe, who was the most famous African-American band leader of the era. And he rhythmically reworks it with woodblocks and snare drums, almost like a march. And I think it's a great example of the cross-influence of black and white musicians in that era. So I want to play that for everybody. This is James Reese Europe. His recording of the song we just heard, made in 1914. We'll hear more of Jerome Kern's early songs after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. This special edition of Fresh Air is devoted to the early songs of Jerome Kern. It's part of our continuing series on the history of American popular song. In the early 1900s, when Kern began his professional songwriting career, Teddy Roosevelt was in the White House, and ragtime was fast becoming the popular music of the day. Here to talk with us about Kern's early songs, composed between 1905 and 1920, is conductor John McGlynn. McGlynn is an authority on Kern's music. Using original scores and texts, McGlynn has directed and conducted restorations on stage and on CD of several Jerome Kern musicals. I asked McGlynn about Kern's place as the first major composer of American theater music.
It's funny, you can think of Kern as, well, really the first American composer of show music as opposed to just a songwriter. And if you think of him, I mean, if you crossed Victor Herbert with George M. Cohan, that's sort of when you would get the music of Jerome Kern. Herbert was an Irishman who was raised in Germany before he came to this country, and he was certainly the king of operetta and was the king of Broadway at the turn of the century. And his great contemporary was George M. Cohan, who was a vaudeville performer and then an actor, wrote his own songs, produced his own plays. And basically, you know, Herbert had this very lush melodic style, and Cohan had this peppy, sassy American drive. Kern suddenly became the amalgam of the two of them. He could write, you know, the peppiest stuff in the world, but then he could turn around and write suddenly these soaring melodies that made you cry without you being able to tell why.
What was the state of the American musical when Kern started writing for the stage?
Basically, the big Broadway hits of that time were imports either from London or from Europe. Viennese operetta was very popular. The Merry Widow swept the world in 1903 and was a huge Broadway hit, I think, in 1905. However, when producers would bring these shows over to America, they felt that these shows needed to be, well, let's say, gently revised for American tastes and have certain American songs put into them, just sort of pep them up a bit and make them more palatable. And this is where the American songwriter got his chance. And virtually every song that Kern wrote from 1902 until 1912 was an interpolation for some other man's show.
So Kern's early songs that were used in musicals were actually used in musicals written by other composers. I'm glad you brought that up because we actually have an excerpt of an interview that Oscar Hammerstein once gave. Hammerstein, the great lyricist who collaborated on many shows with Kern, including Showboat. And Hammerstein was describing one of the ways that Jerome Kern managed to get his songs included into other composers' musicals. And this 1964 recording of Oscar Hammerstein is an excerpt from the Westinghouse Broadcast Corporation series, The Music Goes Round and Round.
Jerry had his first songs interpolated into continental scores by the simple means of becoming the rehearsal pianist when these things were going on over here. And after the cast and the producer and the director were pretty tired of the stale old score they'd been rehearsing for 3 weeks, he would sit down at his piano on the stage and tinkle off a little thing of his own. The cast coming in from lunch would say, "What's that?" And he would say, "Oh, just a little thing that I've written." And everyone would fall in love with it, and he would soon have one of the songs in the foreign score. And very soon he was writing entire scores of his own.
John McGlynn, how did it help Jerome Kern to have his songs interpolated into other people's musicals at the start of his career?
Well, it got him noticed. Usually the interpolations were credited in the program, which means the critics, if they liked the song, would mention it. So it wasn't just that you got paid for the song, you got reviews, you got noticed. And Kern was pretty well known before he ever wrote his first complete score in 1912.
When Jerome Kern was starting out at the turn of the century, he worked as a song plugger in a department store. So his job was to play at the piano songs that were owned by the publishing company that he worked for to promote sheet music sales of those songs. Then later he switched to another publishing company, T.B. Harms, and ended up buying an interest in it and becoming a partner. And I think by the time he was 21, he was part owner of the T.B. Harms publishing company. Sounds like a pretty shrewd move. I'm wondering how that affected his early songwriting career.
Well, of course, it helps to be a part owner of a music publishing house because then you can pretty much dictate what you want of yours to be published. Of course, one of the other advantages of being a part owner of T.B. Harms, which was a publishing company that had worldwide interests, was that Kern started to make constant, frequent trips between New York and London. And so soon he was very well known as a person in London, and it would make sense that the London producers would also say, you know, have you got anything interesting that we can drop into shows? Because, again, remember, it's inconceivable now, but interpolating songs into shows was a common, everyday experience. People never even thought about it.
The first of those interpolations that really became a hit for Kern was in 1905, How'd You Like to Spoon With Me? Why don't we ask our guest singers, Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky, to perform it for us.
I don't know why I am so very shy. I always was demure. I never knew what silly lovers do. No flirting I'd endure. In all my life, I've never kissed a man, I've never winked my eye. But now at last, I'm going to break the ice, so how do you like to try? How'd you like to spoon with me?
I'd like to.
How'd you like to spoon with me?
Well, rather.
Sit beneath an oak tree, large and shady, calling me your tootsie. Wootsie baby, how'd you like to hug and squeeze?
Indeed I would.
Dangle me upon your knees.
If I could.
How'd you like to be my lovey-dovey? How'd you like to spoon with me?
Thanks for performing that. That is really very catchy, but it really does sound dated. How many songs do we have now with the words "tootsie wootsie" in it?
Really?
Oh, just scads.
Really? Or dangle?
We laughed.
Or
we
dangle.
Laughed.
Dangle. Yeah. I want to move on to another song that was interpolated into a show, and the song is "They Didn't Believe Me," and this was used in a 1914 musical called "The Girl from Utah." John, tell us about the importance of this song in Kern's career and in the history of music theater.
Basically, this song, in a way, changed the history of American music literally overnight. I think it's difficult for people to listen to the song now and realize how different it was from everything going on around it. It's almost as though Kern has taken all those European influences of Lehar and Victor Herbert and all of those people and taken the free-soaring lyricism of that and added that sort of American foxtrot rhythm. It's American and it's European and it's all mixed up into a brand new kind of cookie.
Oh, well, let's hear Rebecca Luker, George Dvorsky, would you sing it for us?
We
sure,
will.
Love to.
Got the cutest little way, like to watch you all the day. And it certainly seems fine just to think that you'll be mine. When I see your pretty smile, makes the living worth the while. So I've got to run around telling people what I found. And when I told them how beautiful you are, they didn't believe me. They didn't believe me. Your lips, your eyes, your cheeks, your hair are in a class beyond compare. You're the loveliest girl that one could see.
And when I tell them, and I certainly am going to tell them, that I'm the man whose wife one day you'll be, they'll never believe me. They'll never believe me that from this great big world you've chosen me.
Don't know how it happened quite. May have been the summer night. May have been, well, who can say? Things just happen anyway. All I know is I said yes, hesitating more or less. And you kissed me where I stood, just like any fellow would. And when I told them how wonderful you are, they didn't believe me. They didn't believe me. Your lips, your eyes, your curly hair are in a class beyond compare. From this great big world you've chosen me.
Jerome Kern's 1914 hit, They Didn't Believe Me. Our guest performers, Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky, will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This special edition of Fresh Air, one in a six-part series, An American Popular Song, has been made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. For more than 30 years, expanding America's understanding of who we were, who we are, and who we will be. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Animal Protection Institute, working since 1968 to protect animals from cruelty and abuse. Information online at apiforanimals.org. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to John McGlynn conducting music from Jerome Kern's 1924 musical, Sitting Pretty. Coming up, more songs from Kern's early musicals, including the original version of Bill, the version performed 9 years before Kern and Hammerstein rewrote the song for Showboat.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's program on the early songs of Jerome Kern is part of our series on American popular song. We're focusing on the songs Kern wrote in the early 1900s, before such hits as Smoke It's in Your Eyes and The Way You Look Tonight. After the success of the song They Didn't Believe Me in 1914, Kern started writing musicals of his own. Starting in 1915, he wrote the songs for a groundbreaking series of musicals at New York's Princess Theater. Conductor John McGlynn is an authority on Kern's music and has rediscovered and performed many of Kern's early songs. I asked McGlynn what was unique about Jerome Kern's Princess Theater musicals.
Basically, what was wonderful about them were, A, they were very small. The Princess Theater only sat 300 people, and there was no wing space, which means you had to have one set per act. And so many of the shows of that time were more than just operettas. They were more than just musicals. They were what were called extravaganzas. You look at one of the original posters for Babes in Toyland from 1903, and it says, "Cast of 250, mostly girls." Exclamation point. And it's true. Shows were huge, and people went to the Hippodrome to see these wonderful spectaculars. On the other hand, the Princess Theater, they couldn't do any of that stuff. And so they had to rely on really snappy scripts and really snappy lyrics, because you couldn't dazzle the eye, so you had to dazzle the ear and dazzle the mind. And what was wonderful about the Princess Theater shows, especially by the time the third or fourth of them got rolling, is that Kern began writing them with a librettist named Guy Bolton, with lyrics by the great P.G. Woodhouse. Now, everybody thinks of Woodhouse as the author of the Jeeves books, but he was also one of the great lyricists of the American and British stage for 40 years.
Lyricist Dorothy Fields, who later collaborated with Jerome Kern on such songs as I Won't Dance, The Way You Look Tonight, and A Fine Romance, loved these princess musicals. And I want to play an excerpt of an interview with her from the 1960s, and this interview comes from the archive of the Columbia University Oral History Project. Here's Dorothy Fields.
My first introduction to what I call the respectable musical comedy, which was the Princess Theater, where I went to see all the princess shows. Those were the Wodehouse, Kern. Guy Bolton did the book, J.P. Wodehouse wrote the lyrics, and Jerome Kern did the music. And of course I adored them because they were completely enchanting, all of them. And I never believed, really, that one day I'd be working with Jerome Kern. We always called Jerome, Jerry Kern, the dean, you see, the dean of all light opera or musical comedy, and I think he was. I don't think anybody. I think that Rogers is close to Kern, but I think it was Kern actually who had this lyric simplicity of melody, this direct, straight music line. And of course, I think it was the first time that anybody realized there was such a thing as lyrics. People used to just sing anything. They'd sing because that was the song. But now came a kind of glimmer of brilliance, and people started to say, well, look, there are songs. There can be songs with a good basic thought and a good turn of word. And I must say that everybody who was growing up then pointed, if they had any ideas about the theater, to be able someday to do that kind of musical show that had a story, a legitimate story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and fun on the way.
That was lyricist Dorothy Fields. John McGlynn, George Gershwin was also very influenced by Kern's early musicals. I think Kern became his mentor. Were there other composers who were also influenced by Kern? I'm wondering if you think Kern just had this ripple effect on his contemporaries and the composers a little younger than he.
Kern influenced all of them. I don't think there's a major composer, and I'm thinking now of Cole Porter and Rogers and Gershwin, Arthur Schwartz, all of these people, who didn't see the Princess Theater shows. I mean, if trying to get in to see Oh Boy in 1917 was like trying to get in to see Phantom of the Opera the first year it opened. And for a theater with only 300 seats, that was a very difficult ticket. Dorothy Parker, the famous wit for The New Yorker, in one of her reviews said, "Bolton, Woodhouse, and Kern are my favorite indoor sport." So the trickle-down effect was immense. Richard Rogers even wrote in his memoirs that when he was a teenager and he went to see the Princess Theater shows, first one he saw was Very Good Eddie. He said, to himself, I wanted to grow up and write songs like Jerome Kern wrote. And I think this was true of everybody. And I think Dorothy Fields absolutely put, you know, her finger on it when she said it was the first time that there were lyrics involved that made sense and were funny, and you can credit Woodhouse for that. And I think that's why these shows and these songs attracted such attention, because they were different not just by dint of the glorious music, and it was glorious and funny and hip and very much up to date, but also the incredible verbal virtuosity that went into Woodhouse's lyrics and into Guy Bolton's scripts. I mean, do I dare quote a joke from one of them?
Go ahead.
One of the characters comes rushing in the middle of Sitting Pretty and says, oh, it's terrible, something terrible has happened. Someone else says, lower your voice. And he says, I can't, I'm a tenor.
That is an old joke. My guest is conductor John McGlynn. We'll ask our guest performers, Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky, to sing some songs from the Princess Theater shows after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is a special edition of Fresh Air devoted to the early theater songs of Jerome Kern. My guest John McGlynn is an authority on Kern. Our guest singers are Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky. Luker performed the role of Magnolia in the Harold Prince Broadway revival of Kern's 1927 musical Showboat. George Dvorsky's Broadway shows include The Scarlet Pimpernel, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and Passion. They're going to perform a song from one of the Princess Theater musicals, a song that has survived and is still performed today. It's called Till the Clouds Roll By, and it was written for the 1917 musical Oh Boy, one of Kern's collaborations with P.G. Woodhouse. Here's Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky, Till the Clouds Roll By.
I'm so sad to think that I have had to drive you from your home so coolly.
I'd be gaining nothing by remaining. What would Mrs. Grundy say? Her conventions, kindly recollect them. We must please respect them duly.
My intrusion needs explaining. I felt my courage waning.
Please, I beg, don't mention it. I should not mind a bit. But it has started raining.
Oh, the rain comes a pitter-patter, and I'd like to be safe in bed. Skies are weeping while the world is sleeping, trouble heaping on us. Chatter and to wait for a clearer sky. Helter skelter, I must fly for shelter till the clouds roll by.
What bad luck, it's coming down in buckets. Have you an umbrella?
I've a warm coat, waterproof, a storm coat. I shall be all right, I know. Later on, too, I will ward the grip off with a little nip of brandy.
Or a glass of toddy draining. You'd find that more sustaining.
Don't be worried, I entreat. I've rubbers for my feet, so I don't mind it raining.
Oh, the rain comes a pitter-patter, and I'd like to be safe in bed. skies are weeping while the world is sleeping, trouble heaping on our head. It is vain to remain and chatter and to wait for a clearer sky. Helter skelter, I must fly for shelter till the clouds roll by.
That was really beautiful. Rebecca Luker, George Dvorsky, thank you for singing that.
Thank you.
Rebecca, George, you've both sung plenty of theater music. From your perspective as singers, what are some of the distinguishing characteristics of early Kern? Part of the pleasure that it gives you and part of the difficulty of singing it?
Both. There's no room to breathe in his songs.
He writes really long lines.
Yes, he writes very long lines, soaring melodies, and intervals are always so, they're so huge. It takes a very good line in your voice to be able to sing them correctly.
And those intervals very don't difficult. Always land where you think they're
yes.
going to. He likes to throw you a curve.
Oh, no, he does. You can't tell where he's going. But then when you get there, it's very satisfying and it makes sense, you know.
Well, why don't we hear another early Jerome Kern song? And this one is called It Wasn't Your Fault. It's from a 1917 musical called Love of Mike. John McGlynn, would you introduce the song for us?
Well, it's the first love song in the first act. It's about a man who is a congenital liar who has met the girl who is finally going to reform him, but he doesn't know that yet.
Okay. George, Rebecca, would you sing it for us?
Surely.
I'd love to.
I always thought girls should not be slaves of love, but fancy free. That was before you came along. Of course, I see now I was wrong. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't anybody's fault.
Laughed at men whose lives were ruled by fiancés and wives. My heart was independent quite till I met you, and then good night. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't anybody's fault at all. I saw your smile, your wonderful smile. It held my heart in thrall. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't my fault. There isn't anybody else to blame. And if you should refuse me now,
it's too late, you can't lose me now.
I've got to love you just the same.
Well, that was great. Thank you, Rebecca Luker and George Dvorsky with pianist William Hicks. Now, although Jerome Kern is a departure from operetta and gives us an American music theater voice, he's also in his own way very connected to operetta, more so than, say, Irving Berlin or George Gershwin. Do you think that his class has anything to do with that, in the sense that he's from a much more prosperous immigrant family than, say, Gershwin or Berlin?
I think there's a lot to be said for that. Berlin and Gershwin came from very poor backgrounds originally. Gershwin less so, but Berlin, his family was really struggling. They came from Russia. And there, especially in Berlin, there's a real ethnic flavor to the lyrics that he wrote at the beginning. I mean, he wrote about life as it was experienced around him. I mean, the things he saw people doing, buying fish from the fishmonger or going up to Harlem to see a show and all of that. All three of these men were Jewish, and Gershwin's music in Berlin really reflects that ethnic heritage. Kern, on the other hand, really is sort of the last step in the evolution from European opera to American music. And he, you know, he sort of lived in cloud cuckoo land. I mean, even his own personal and home life, everything was designed to shelter him from anything that would distract these luscious melodies coming out. And Gershwin wanted to capture the sound of the city he was living in. Kern wanted to shut it out of his theaters, bring an audience in, and give them 3 hours of fantasy, grace, and charm.
John McGlynn. We'll talk more with McGlynn and hear more of Jerome Kern's early music after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is a special edition of Fresh Air devoted to the early songs of Jerome Kern. One of Kern's great songs was written earlier than you may think. One of the songs from his groundbreaking 1927 musical Showboat, the song Bill, was actually written before Showboat for another musical. John McGlynn, tell us the story here.
Well, it first appeared in a show called Oh Lady Lady, which opened out of town in late 1917. It was cut from the show because it was the second number in the show and they felt it was too slow to be that close to the opening. And it was a rather different song. It had a lyric by P.G. Wodehouse, and it was basically sort of a comedy song, believe it or not. But they cut it. It went into the trunk. They tried to put it into several other shows, and for various reasons, it didn't work. And when they were trying to find a torch song for Helen Morgan, Kern remembered Bill. But, of course, as I said, it was a comedy song. So Hammerstein had to rewrite a little bit of it to de-comedify it, and Kern recomposed a few bars of music. And with just, you know, basically changes in 8 bars of it, it became from a sweet, gentle, romantic comedy song to one of the great tragic moments in American musical theater.
Well, we're in for a real treat because I'm going to ask Rebecca Luker to sing the original P.G. Wodehouse lyric and then to sing an excerpt of Hammerstein's rewrite of the lyric. Rebecca, why don't you start with the P.G. Wodehouse original lyric?
I'd love to.
I used to dream that I would discover the perfect lover someday. I knew I'd recognize him if ever he came round my way. I always used to fancy then he'd be one of the godlike kind of men, with a giant brain and a noble head, like the heroes bold in the books I read. But along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never know sees him, his form and face, his manly grace, is not the kind that you would find in a statue. And I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill. I love him because he's wonderful, because he's just old Bill. He can't play golf or tennis or polo or sing a solo or row. He isn't half as handsome as dozens of men that I know. He isn't tall and straight and slim, and he dresses far worse than Ted or Jim. And I can't explain why he should be just the one man in the world for me. He's just my Bill, an ordinary boy. He hasn't got a thing that I can brag about, and yet to be
was absolutely beautiful, Rebecca. Thank you for singing that.
Thank you. My favorite song.
Is it?
One of them, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you to just demonstrate a little bit of how Oscar Hammerstein rewrote it. And this is the version from Showboat.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Rebecca Luker.
Thank you very much.
Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein wrote the 1927 musical Showboat, which ushers in a whole new era of the modern musical. And I'd like to end with the overture that Jerome Kern wrote for Showboat. Let's end by ushering in the new era that Jerome Kern helped to start. And John McGlynn, you did a wonderful CD restoration of Showboat, which included music that had been excluded from a lot of productions. And just say a few words about the very opening of this overture.
Well, this overture that nobody dares to play, everybody cuts it because they're so afraid of it. You have to remember, this show was produced by Florenz Ziegfeld, who, you know, the Ziegfeld Follies. You went to a Ziegfeld show. You were going expecting 200 beautiful women, some of them topless, coming down innumerable staircases, bugle beads for days. That's what Ziegfeld was. So imagine, you know, opening night, Mr. First Nighter audience going to the Ziegfeld Theater to a Ziegfeld show, scored by Jerome Kern, and they sit down in their seats, and suddenly they hear this overture, dark, brooding, tragic. What on earth was going on? I'm sure they were absolutely bewildered.
And with that, I want to thank you, John McGlynn. I want to thank our performers, Rebecca Luker, George Dvorsky, and William Hicks. It's been a wonderful program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerome Kern's overture for the 1927 debut of Showboat, as restored in 1988 by John McGlynn. We're listening to McGlynn conducting the London Sinfonietta. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our series on American popular song is produced in collaboration with Margaret Pick and the Pacific Vista Productions team, including Terry Bronson. Anne-Marie Baldonado is the series' associate producer. Music recording by Jim Zack at NOLA Studios in New York. Joyce Lieberman is technical supervisor for our series. Additional recording from Bob Purdick. Our thanks to Andrew Booz and the estate of Jerome Kern, Miles Kruger of the Institute of American Musical Theater, Robert Kimball, artistic advisor of the Ira and Lenore Gershwin Trusts, Hugh Forden of DRG Records, Bert Fink of the Richard Rogers Estate, Alan Lowe, Margaret Whiting, and Bill Hammerstein. And thanks to the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University, the Library of Congress Department of Recorded Sound, the Columbia University Oral History Project, and Cinema Sound. I'm Terry Gross.
This special edition of Fresh Air, one in a six-part series on American popular song, has been made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. For more than 30 years, expanding America's understanding of who we were, who we are, and who we will be. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Yoga and the Quest for the True Self by Stephen Cope, an exploration of yoga as the path to self-awareness and as a tool for emotional healing. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Archbishop Desmond Tutu discusses his recent work chairing South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which offered amnesty in return for truthful accounts of politically and racially motivated atrocities. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.